Morning, everyone. James Lee, alcoholic. Clint, thanks so much. Wow, that was... I usually don't cry till later in my talk, and here I am over here crying in that introduction, so thank you. Love you, brother. I'm extra nervous today. I don't know why. Yes, I do, but I'm just extra nervous. My sobriety date's January 3rd, 1984. I'm a grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love being sober. I want to start with some thank yous before I get started here. First, Sonia, thank you so much for the music. Can we give her another hand? And that song had a line, and Sonia, I'm going to do my best with it, so correct me, please. Sweet surrender that saved my life. Is that right? Yeah. That's my talk. Can I sit down? Am I done? That's it. So thank you so much. It's amazing. And other thank yous, Dick and Barbara, thanks guys for inviting us. I love being a part of these things and being, but especially when I'm with Jane and when I'm with my mom and Dave. So thank you so much for that. And I want to thank Mildred and Ralph for the amazing talks Thursday night and then last night. Thanks, you guys. All right. Usually when I'm nervous, I like to start with a joke. But I only have one joke. So, you guys want to hear it? It's a good joke. It's good. Okay, it's about my mom, Polly. Did y'all know Polly's my mom, Polly P? Okay. Now, this joke requires a little participation, so can y'all help me out? Okay, here goes. My mom's Polly P. How about that? Hey, does anybody know what the P stands for? Pistol. Pistol. Polly Pistol. How about that for a name? Now, I think that happens to be a perfect name for my mom, because if there's a pistol at Alcoholics Anonymous, it's my mom. Don't you agree? She's a pistol. Well, if you think she's a pistol now, you should have seen her loaded. That's it. That's my one joke. All right. She loves that joke, by the way. I've been asked to share about steps 1, 2, and 3, and I'm going to do so to the best of my ability. And it's really an honor to talk about these steps, especially step 3, which is one of my favorite steps. I'll start by saying, obviously, I'm a child of an alcoholic. I should have never taken a drink, and I'll just briefly tell you why. This is a bit of my mom's story, but it's important that I tell you this. I was raised not only in an alcoholic home, but in a military home. My dad was an Air Force officer. He served from, 1960-ish, 59, to 1973 or 4. Unless I forget to tell you guys this, I when I was a kid, I had issues with my dad, as most adolescent boys do, but I want you to know today he's one of my heroes for sure. But anyway, in this alcoholic home, my mom, the alcoholic, she's a pretty bad alcoholic back then, just so you know. I've heard her share 100 times. She never gets it how bad she was. But anyway, I'm picking on you today. I'm sorry about that. Anyway, at the end of 1976, she started to go in and out of treatment in Tarrant County, Texas. We were living in Hearst, Texas, which is a suburb of Fort Worth. She started to go in and out of detox, including the Tarrant County detox there, and she was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. She liked AA, didn't think she was an alcoholic, and didn't want to live anymore, and she decided to die by suicide. So what she did was she went to an Air Force doctor and got a bottle of Valium. Went to a liquor store, got a bottle of scotch, checked herself into a motel, ate that bottle of pills, drank that bottle of scotch, and waited to die. A friend of hers, a non-alcoholic friend, knew something was wrong and was compelled to start looking for my mom and found her car outside this motel in Euless, Texas. And, you know, those kind where you park right in front of your door. She found her car. She pushed on the door. My mom had left it open. And my mom's friend found my mom passed out on the floor, called 911. The ambulance picked her up, and she flatlined on the way to the hospital, so she was dead. They resuscitated her, obviously. And they said, Polly, this is a result of alcohol. We suggest you don't drink again. And that was not her last drink. Now, I was 14 years old. I wasn't in the ambulance. I wasn't in that motel room, but I heard about what happened, and here's what I learned at the age of 14. I was pretty smart. I learned this. Alcoholics who drink die. That's what I learned. That was my personal experience of my family. And eventually she had her last drink on April the 11th, 1977, went to treatment in Dallas, Texas, and that treatment center had something called Family Day. I don't know if they do that here in Georgia, but they did it in Texas, and off the family goes to Family Day. And so here's my family. There was my mom, the alcoholic, my dad, let me tell you about him in a second, my brother who was 16, and me, 14. Now my dad, when my mom started going in and out of those treatment centers, he started going to Al-Anon. And Al-Anon, in short order, transformed my dad from an enabling spouse of an alcoholic to a man who had his wife court committed to treatment. Now, thank God for that. Because here's what I believe, this is my belief, that had my dad not had my mom court committed to treatment, she would not be sober today. And had she not got sober at that time, I don't think I would have got sober. So I believe that my dad, by taking that action, saved not only my mom's life, but my life. So thank God for Al-Anon, huh? Thank God for Al-Anon. Yeah. All right. Family Day. So we're in there. The therapist starts talking about alcoholism. I think kind of like, hey, kids, this is what mom's got. Let me share it with you so you understand and able to help. And she started to describe alcoholism. Now, I'm going to share with you what she said that day. And actually, let me correct that. I'm going to share with you what I heard her say that day, right? Which may, in fact, not be what she said. Anybody else here hear things that aren't said and don't hear things that are said? That's me. Anyway, this is what I remember was said that day. She began to describe alcoholism. And what I'm going to do is share with you what I heard her say that day as a description of alcoholism. I don't want you to think that I believe that this is a description of every alcoholic. Okay? If you want a description of alcoholism, the best description I've ever seen is in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So go there. That's where the description. But I was 14. I didn't know Big Book. I don't know what that was. So I'm in this therapist's office, and she begins to speak, and I start hearing things. And first of all, I found her very credible. I believe she knew what she was talking about. I don't know if she did. But here's what she said alcoholics were like. She said alcoholics are people who are uncomfortable in their own skin. They don't fit. They don't feel like they belong. They feel apart from, less than, unloved and unlovable. And I want you to know at the age of 14, that is exactly how I felt. And I don't believe, I cannot remember a time where I did not feel that way. I'm sure there was a time when I didn't feel that way, but I don't remember it. And when she said that, I said to myself, man, that's me. And then she continued the description. She said, alcoholics are people who have an idea of the way the world should be. And if this idea of the world, this sort of vision of utopia, were to come about, the entire world would be pleased. Everyone would be happy. All right? I'm hearing this and I'm thinking, I have a vision of utopia, and I'm sure everyone would love it. And the only problem is people don't behave. That's the only problem, right? You don't do what I want you to do. But you know, it says that in the big book. In chapter 5 when it's talking about step 3, that we have an idea of the way the world should be. I want to be that director that runs the show, right? Arrange all of you, and if I get you all arranged right, the whole world would be amazing, and you guys would be grateful for my arrangement. That's what it is. The only problem is the rest of you want to be the director, and so we kind of, you know, step on each other's toes. But anyway, she said, this one got me. She said, alcoholics suffer from belligerent defiance. And man, did I suffer from that. Now again, I don't want to say that every alcoholic is this description, but it described me, right? It described me. And I was like, oh my gosh, it's getting hot in here, you know? She's describing alcoholism and I'm identifying down the line. And then she said something. This is the whole point of this story, right here. She said something. Now, I have never found this in any conference-approved literature. I don't know if it was true when she said it. I don't know if it's true today. But here's what she said. And when she said it, I believed it. That's what's important. She said this. If you are a child of an alcoholic, you have a 50-50 chance of being an alcoholic yourself. Now, she just described alcoholism. I identified with every single characteristic. And I thought, oh, man. And math was my best subject. So I knew what 50-50 meant. So I looked at my brother, and I looked at me, and I said, ain't going to be him, you know. It's me. Now, if y'all were around yesterday, you heard us share about the fact that on Thursday, which is Thanksgiving, my brother will celebrate 4 years of sobriety. So, yeah, let's give Russ a hand. So 100% in our family. Anyway, so I was 14. So here's what I knew at the age of 14. I knew that alcoholics who drink die, and if I drink, I'm going to be an alcoholic. And at the age of 14, I did not want to die. That would come later. But at that day, I didn't want to die. So I made a great decision. I said, I'm never going to drink. Pretty smart, huh? That I was given a gift that day, and that gift was self-knowledge. And what the big book is very clear about is self-knowledge does not work for alcoholics. So I had to take a drink, and I did so 5 months later in September 1977. I don't know if anyone... Does anyone here remember September 1977? Some of us were there, yeah. Those of us were there, like, I don't remember it, you know. Anyway, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, right? So I take a drink, I'll be an alcoholic, I don't want to do that. I go to school, and I brought the same kid to school that day, I brought it to school every day. I felt apart from, less than, unloved, unlovable. I felt like I didn't fit, I didn't belong, didn't have any friends. I go to school, this dude David comes up to me, and he says, you want to come with us? First of all, I didn't know him. I didn't know where we're going, I didn't know what we're going to do, and I said, yeah. So... We crossed Brown Trail there, crossed from Eldie Bell High School, which is where we were, and we went in the woods, and we did something. We partook in an outside issue. Now, I don't need to go into any details, but I will mention that rolling papers were involved. That's all I'll say about that, okay? And pass that around, let me tell you, my life changed just like that. What happened was that kid who felt apart from, less than, unloved, unlovable, in an instant was somebody who fit and had friends. I found out his name was David, and he was now my best friend. And I wanted to be just like him. He was a senior. I was a sophomore. Let me describe him to you. He had really long hair. September 77? Think Robert Plant from Led Zeppelin. Yeah. That's what he looked like. And he had a Led Zeppelin t-shirt because they returned that summer. And he had really red eyes. And I said, I want what he has. So I did everything to try to get that. So I'm not a purist. I didn't just drink. I did whatever I get my hands on. I don't have to go into any details, but I smoked a lot of weed. I snorted a lot of cocaine. I took a lot of pills. I did some other hard stuff, and I drink a lot of whiskey, but I identify as an alcoholic. And I'll tell you why. I have alcoholism, right? I have alcoholism. And to me, alcoholism is really, as I said, described in the big book. In the doctor's opinion, he talks about something called a physical allergy. I have that. As a matter of fact, so what is this physical allergy? It's this physical component of our disease, which if I take a drink, I have a compulsion to take another and another and another. And I want you to know, that happened the first day. I did what we did, and it was like a fire hose turned on, and I didn't stop for 6.5 years. I was drunk or under the influence of something else every day for 6.5 years. And, you know, I was 15. You say, how did you do that at 15? Oh, we do that really well. And I drank from 15 to 21. And so I had that. I never took a social drink. I don't know what that means. I drank for one reason, and that is to still the disease of alcoholism. And let me tell you, the other part of the doctor's opinion is this idea, some folks call it the obsession of the mind of the alcoholic, our sick thinking. I had that too. And my sick thinking manifests in many different ways. The one that is talked about a lot in the book is this. Regardless of my experience, I always think that I can have just one safely, and I suffer from that. I also suffer from a lot of other alcoholic thinking, which includes, to me anyway, that I there's something terribly wrong with me, and it's very necessary for me to hide that from you. I just have this mind that works on me. A lot of us call it the committee. It's this chatter that happens in my head. And that chatter always talks about me, and it never says anything good. And but when I drank, that my mind would quiet, my body would relax. And I also believe that alcoholism is a spiritual illness. There's something wrong with my spirit. And I experienced that physically. And I experienced it right here behind my sternum. I have this chronic ache. This, like, constant hurt. It's like a tightness in my chest, and when I would drink, that tightness would go away for a little while, and that's why I drink. You know, it talks in that doctor's opinion about alcoholics drink for the effect produced by alcohol. So here's the effect produced by alcohol for me. That pain would go away for a little while, my mind would quiet for a little while, and I felt like I fit for a little while, and that's exactly why I drank. I drank for no other reason. That's my alcoholism. Now, I should tell you this, that there's other stuff going on while I was drinking that includes my mom. I'm sorry, I'm going to talk more about my mom. She got sober in April 77. I started drinking in September 77. It took a while for the kind of the fog to lift with her, and she sort of started coming around, seeing reality, and her eyes fell on me. And said, my son is working up a story. He's in trouble. I'm going to fix this. And so she took it into her own hands to get me sober. And here's what she would say to me. She'd say this. And by the way, if you have kids or will have kids, I highly recommend you do not say these things to them. But here's what she said. She said, James, we're saving a seat for you in Alcoholics Anonymous. I cannot wait for you to join AA. You can join my home group. I've got a great sponsor picked out for you named Mark. And you and I will trudge this road of happy destiny together. Now, she said these things to me, not once, repeatedly, for years. Okay? And I was 15, 16, 17. Now, listen. If you're a 15-year-old kid that suffers from belligerent defiance, and your mom says, can't wait for you to join AA, what do you think I said? Oh, heck no. No, 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 that's not going to happen. Don't you know I'm different? Don't you know I know about alcoholism. I knew from before I took my first drink about alcoholism, right? That's what that therapist gave me, that self-knowledge. I said, no way. I was never going to join AA, okay? So, fast forward, that was my alcoholism. I don't have any real dramatic stories. I always thought that, I didn't like wreck cars or go to prison or any of that kind of stuff. But what slowly happened over time was that what alcoholism did for this, for me, is it essentially separated any connection that I had to a power greater than myself. And I want y'all to know that when I was 7, 6, I believed there was a God. I believed that God existed. I believed that God had power. I experienced it a little bit. But through my, living in a home with alcoholism and through my own drinking, I had moved myself from a young person who felt connected to God to 21 years old, and I was completely separated. Mildred talked about Thursday night with that Chuck C. said to her, your problem is you think you're separate. And when I ended my drinking at the age of 21, that was my experience. I felt separated from God, from you, from life. Okay, that's what alcoholism did for me. Did to me, I should say. Now, here's the ironic part of my story. Here I was at the age of 15, about to take my first drink. I felt apart from, separate, different, unloved, unlovable. I want you to know all that was a lie. I believed a lie. And in the terms that we use in AA, I had a delusion about that. Okay. Fast forward 6.5 years, I had created that very thing in my life. I had created that through my alcoholism. I felt, not only did I feel apart from, less than, and different, I was. I was living in a house in North Richland Hills, Texas, with a bunch of alcoholic dope fiends like myself. There's 5 of us there. We had parties all the time. I was surrounded by people like us, and I never felt so alone. And that's what alcoholism did to me. So no big dramatic ending, but here's the ending that I experienced. I went to a party on December 31st, 1983. I got incredibly wasted that night. I was just so drunk. And my last memory that night was I was on the porch of this house in Fort Worth, this wooden house with this wooden porch. I remember it was like a blue-gray paint on the porch floor, whatever you call it, and I was crawling, trying to make it to the porch railing because I was going to get sick. And, through it all, I was considerate. I was going to throw up in the bushes, It's kind of nice. And I was a nice guy, right? Anyway, I was heading that way, blacked out. And I came to on January 3rd. And this is what I came to. And I love, Mildred, I loved your talk Thursday because I identified with what you were talking about. And this was my experience. Now, from the age of 14, I knew about alcoholism, and I had convinced myself of this. I made this lie a truth in my mind. I will not become an alcoholic because I know about alcoholism. Right, so I'm not going to be an alcoholic. I'm not going to be like my mom. I'm not going to be like those people in those AA meetings that I went to as a teenager. I'm not going to be like them. And moreover, I really liked being drunk. Okay? And now I've experienced this throughout my drinking. I ignored the signs. I convinced myself that I wasn't alcoholic. This was my ego doing all this. And I believed all these lies. To me, that's delusion. And what happened was, I came to on January 3rd, and it was as though a bright light had been turned on in my mind and in my heart. And I came to, and I was like, oh my God, I'm an alcoholic. And I was like, wow, I'm an alcoholic. Now, I want you to know the day before I was in a blackout, but I'm assuming that the day before was like every other day before, and that was I was not alcoholic. And this day I came to and I was an alcoholic. And that, I believe, is a miracle. Somehow my mind changed. Somehow I had a realization of the truth. And I love that word, realization, like reality came to my mind that I'm an alcoholic. Something about my mind changed. Today, I believe, I did not know this at the time, but I believe what happened that day is a power greater than myself literally reached into my life and touched me in a way that thought came into my mind. I knew it was true. And that thought wasn't enough. It was followed by another thought, I want to be sober. That was what was in my mind January 3rd. And I haven't had a drink since. Yeah. You're clapping for that power, by the way. Greater than myself. But here I am, 21. What do you do? Remember, I'm 21 years old. I've just come to this realization. What do you do? I didn't know what to do, so I did something really lame. And I'm going to share it with you, but please don't judge me, okay? No judgment? I called my mom, right? 21-year-old tough guy picks up the phone. Remember the days where phones had wires? And I push those buttons. Mom, guess what? I'm an alcoholic. James, no kidding. You know, I've known this for years. And then she said, oh, I've been praying for this day. Oh, gosh, here she goes. And I said, Mom, I want what you have. I want to be sober. And she said, James, if you want what I have, I suggest you go to AA. And I said, Mom, I don't want it that bad. On the phone. Click. Did I tell you I wasn't going to come to AA? Told you that, right? Yeah, don't say AA to me. So here I am. Now, it took me years to understand what happened. I want to share with you what I believe happened. I believe what I experienced that day was I came to in a state of surrender. It was as though, I believe, God surrendered me. Did you hear that? He surrendered me. I did not surrender. I woke up in a state of surrender. And I did not do anything for this, right? I've heard stories. Dave's story is an example. Dave drank a fifth of vodka a day. Was it vodka? Did Dave drink vodka? Scotch? Whatever. It's a fifth. Fifth of something. Every day. He went to AA. He was going to the therapist who suggested AA. He went to AA. He went drunk. He would drink on the way to the meeting, drink on the way home, and they would give him, they were consistent with their message, Dave, we can't help you get sober. You need help from a power greater than yourself. And he said, I don't believe in God. And they said, doesn't matter, ask anyway. And one day he asked, on April 16th, 1976, he woke up on April 17th, 1976, and that's his sobriety date. Now that's his story. He asked, it came. That's not my story. I didn't ask. I didn't want it. It just happened. Okay? So I feel like I was in a state of, I was given the gift of surrender by this power. So I like to say about myself that I'm an example of a person for whom miracles can occur without my consent. Because that's exactly what happened. I didn't want it. It just happened. And today I consider that one of my greatest gifts. Is this state of surrender. Then I call my mom. I'm alcoholic. Yeah, we knew. I want to be sober. Go to AA. I don't want it that bad. Hung up the phone. Guess what I did? 5 minutes after I came to, I unsurrendered myself. Anybody ever do that? My ego reconstructed itself like that. And I removed myself from this state of surrender. Now, when I was in this state of surrender, this is just a vague memory because it was so long ago, but I really felt like in that moment, And not, it's like what Jane says in her talk. It's not that everything is going to be okay. It's that everything is okay. And I felt in that moment, everything is okay. Everything is okay. I felt peace. My mind was quiet. I felt that ache was gone without being drunk. And that was a gift. And then I unsurrendered myself. I was afraid. I was in my self-centeredness. I was in my control. I have to control everything. And I was back in that state that I had lived in for so long. And I love this analogy. I heard Peg M. from Nebraska give it. I'm going to share this analogy. He says, it's like, you ever hear this boxing analogy? Where, so here I'm a boxer, and I'm fighting alcoholism, and I'm getting beat up really bad. And over in the corner is my trainer, my manager. And that's God. And God said to me on January 3rd, kid, it's not your night. And God threw in the towel for me. Does that make sense? He surrendered me. I made that call. My ego reconstructed itself. And I reached back in that ring and I pulled my towel back. This is my towel. And my sobriety has been 38 years of tearing off little pieces of that towel and throwing it in the ring. Now let me tell you something. The towel that God threw in the ring, it wasn't like a hand towel. It wasn't even a bath towel. This thing was a huge beach towel, right? So I got this big beach towel, that's my ego. Tearing off little pieces of it. And that is the story of my sobriety right there. So, But I was not going to go to AA after I unsurrendered myself. And herein begins a year of my life that was what it took to convince me that I was an alcoholic. So, Mom, I'm alcoholic. Oh, I don't want it that bad. Click. Ego comes in. You kind of overreacted there, James. And so I started to fix myself. Anybody ever do that? I don't need AA. I got this. All right? Here's what I mistakenly thought. This is another lie that I told myself. Another delusional thought. Alcohol is my problem. And by the way, when January 3rd happened, I knew it was over. Just like Mildred talked about. I knew it was over. I'm done. I knew I'm never going to drink again. I just knew it. Something inside of me said, it's over. You're done drinking. And I thought, after my ego reconstructed itself, that's great news. Because alcohol is my problem. And if alcohol is no longer in my life, problem solved. Makes sense, right? Problem solved. I don't need AA. I don't need anybody's help. I'm going to do this on my own. So this began a year of my life where I treated myself for my alcoholism. And I, a very strange thing happened. And that is I got sicker. I had this idea that alcohol taken out of my life, life's going to get better. I'm going to be better and better, right? Wrong. I got so sick, you guys. I've never been so sick. I was sick mentally. The thoughts, the committee, whatever you want to call it, was turned up to 11. My emotions were like this. I went from deeply depressed to incredibly manic. I had this pain right here, continued to get worse and tighter and tighter. And I believe, had I not eventually had the experience I'm about to share with you, I would have drank. But I didn't. But I got so sick. Now, I dabbled in AA. What that meant was I knew how to get to a meeting. I knew how meetings were. Back in the day, before the internet, we had like printed copies of directories, AA meeting directories, so I had one of those. And I would go to AA meetings every now and again. But I was one of these fringe members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know if anyone did this. I would come into the meeting late and leave early. No sponsor, no big book, no fellowship. I would leave before the prayer, and I would sit in the back row. And the back row, my sponsor, Frank Honeycutt, would tell me. The back row is called the shoe section. You guys ever hear this? It's the shoe section. It's where the loafers and the sneakers and the slippers sit. So I was present company excluded, y'all. So you're good. You're good. But when I sat back there, I was a guy waiting to take a drink. All right? And I kept getting sicker. And one day, I think it was about a year later, I'm not very clear when this happened, I got a phone call from a woman named Barbara, who happened to be a woman my mom sponsored. And I knew Barbara because our house and her house was separated by a fence in Hearst, Texas. I used to run the streets with her kids, so I knew her. She got sober, and she called me. And she said, James, I have this gal that I sponsor. She needs to get to a meeting. I've asked everyone I know. No, all the women I've asked can't take her. Will you please take her? And I found myself giving an answer that was really out of character for me. I said, yes, I'll do that. And why was it out of character? Because I believe what it says in chapter 5 there when it's talking about step 3, that my alcoholism, the root of it, is selfishness and self-centeredness. And my normal reaction or response to such a request would have been, no, I got something to do. But I heard myself say yes. So what happened was, I went to a part of town I'd never been to, picked up someone I didn't know, took them to a meeting I'd never been to. Right? And I walked in, and there's like, see these tables right here? Imagine them pushed together. So it was one long table like that. I sat down, and right across from me sat the speaker of that meeting. I didn't know. He and I were chatting, and he and I had a lot in common. We kind of looked the same, the same age, liked the same music. Then he started telling the story, and it turned out we drank the same. And there's one big difference. I was dying of alcoholism, miserable, and he was happy, joyous, and free because he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous working the program. And that day, I got the gift of hope. Okay? So, another example of a miracle occurring in my life without my consent. Last thing I want to do is join AA, and here I suddenly find myself in Alcoholics Anonymous because of this guy. And I am so incredibly grateful. So it really took a year for me to really take step 1 and step 2. And it took a year for my reconstructed ego to be smashed to the point where I could fully concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. And the reason I fully conceded it is because I identified with that guy. So I often say to myself, I went to one meeting too many, and I caught alcoholism. So if you're here today and you're like, I don't know if I'm an alcoholic, I don't want to be an AA, you know, I was dragged here by a family member or a sponsor, I want to say especially to you, welcome. Because that's my story. I didn't want to be here. I didn't want to be an AA. I went to one meeting too many, and the miracle happened. And so this is my belief, based on my experience, that if you're here and you don't want to be here, welcome. Because it doesn't matter why you're here. It literally did not matter why I was in that AA meeting. It was the fact that I was there, right? I kind of got dragged to it by this woman that my mom sponsored. I use that figuratively. She didn't drag me, but she's the one that made that happen. And the miracle happened to me. So if you're wondering if AA works for you, just keep coming. And hopefully that miracle will happen for you too. So that day, I fully conceded to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic, which is what we must do with step 1. And what that means was I had to admit that I had absolutely no power over alcohol. I knew that. And that was, my life was unmanageable. I didn't know that before. That miracle happened to me on January 3rd, I knew I was powerless over alcohol, and it was gone. It was over, but I got this life thing. I can manage my life. I got it. And then this year happened where I got sicker and sicker and sicker. And then I went to this meeting and was able to say that I am powerless and my life is unmanageable. And by the way, my life was unmanageable sober. Now, I use the word sober loosely because I wasn't really sober. I was practicing what we in Chicago called sobriety. I don't know if anyone ever... You guys, anybody? Sobriety? That was me. So I have this moment. I take step one. Then this guy shared his story about this power in his life. And I was confronted with this step two question. Now, I was this little, felt the presence of God, felt this power. Fast forward to 21, no connection whatsoever. And the way I like to describe it is, I felt like I had this, when I was a kid, I had this candle inside me. Interestingly, right in the same point I pointed to where the alcoholism manifested in my life physically with that chronic ache, right here I had this, like a candle lit, right? Fast forward, 21, it was as though through my alcoholism, through the people I hurt, through the actions that I took, it is as though I blew that candle out and there was no connection. And then I'm confronted with this question of step two, that I come to believe that there is some power greater than myself that will restore me to sanity. Now, there's two parts of that step for me. The first is that I come to believe there's some power greater than myself. And remember, I have vague memories of that actually being true. And the other is that I be restored to sanity, which is a sideways saying, way of saying I'm insane. Now, I don't know about you guys, but that kind of hurt my feelings, thinking that I'm insane. I don't like that idea. Now, I've come to believe, through studying the Big Book and living a sober life, that there's a couple definitions of that insanity. The first definition is out of the Big Book. And it's the idea of the insane thought which precedes the first drink. That's what the Big Book talks about. Such as, I can have one drink because I just got paid. Or I can have one drink because I'm broke. Or I can have one drink because she sure is pretty. Or I can have one drink because it's nighttime. Or I can have one drink because it's the morning. These are all the insane thoughts, right? And my mind sort of succumbs to that thought. I take the first drink, and then the physical allergy is active, and I'm on, right? So restore me to sanity means that that insane thought which precedes the first drink is removed from my mind, and that has happened for me. That's happened. I cannot remember the last time I really had a serious thought of taking a drink. I do remember this one. This was in I got sober in 1984. Let's call this 1989. I had this job where, maybe it was 1990. I had a job where they flew me over to Japan for some work. So here I'm over in Japan. I flew, 17 hours over there, got off the plane, went to work, worked 12-hour day. Then we all went out to dinner. And I was tired, and I was jet-lagged, and now by this time I was 6 years sober, 7 years sober, something like that. And I was tired, crabby, and then all of a sudden we're sitting at this big table, and the wait staff comes out and just starts boom, boom, right in front of everybody, these big steins of beer. Now these aren't like little ones, this is a big stein of beer, and it's big old handle on it, and the when they put them in the freezer and it's got the nice little frost on the outside and the foam was spilling over perfectly. Okay, and I'm looking at this and a thought enters my mind. This is an insane thought which precedes the first drink. Doesn't the Big Book say I can have a drink if I'm 8,000 miles away from home? That was my thought. And like the book says, later, I think it's step 10. When tempted, we recoil as if from a hot flame. That happened like that. I went, whoa. And I had a moment of sanity return. I said to the wait staff, I can't drink that, I'm allergic. Now, they didn't know what that meant, but I did. And they brought a soft drink, and I was fine. That's the insane thought. That's gone. For the most part, that's gone. I don't have that anymore. So what else does insanity mean? To me, it means this. I don't know if I can share this, how I really feel about this, but I believe there was a time in my life where I knew there was a power greater than myself, and I lived in that power. I believe there was a time. We were talking about this last night, that if you want to see the eyes of God, look in the eyes of children. A couple back there. That's where God is, right? I was there once, and I believed that I lived in a sane world, which is a state of surrender to that power. I lived there, right? So, to me, being restored to sanity is being returned to that state of surrender. That's what it means for me. Now, I didn't know this when I was doing the first step two, but that's how I feel about step two today. So, do I believe there's a power greater than myself that can restore me to that place? Now, I believe that can remove the insane thought which precedes the first drink, because that's happened. But do I really believe there's a power that can restore me to that state? And for a long time, the answer was no. But I believe there is this power now. I believe this power exists. And the reason I believe it is because I have experienced that state. I've experienced it. And so then I'm presented with step three, which is made a decision to turn my will and life over to the care of God as we understood Him. And to me, my thinking about this step is that what this is essentially a commitment to do what's necessary to return me to that state, right? To turn my will and life over to God's care, to return me to that state that those kids are in right now. And what that means to me today is that I make a commitment to do steps 4 through 12. That's what that means to me today. So when I'm working with someone new, that's exactly how I state it to them. Step 3 is you don't turn it over. You commit to do the work where the turning over can happen. Now I want you to know, I had this idea that I was able to surrender myself. And Chuck C. has been mentioned this weekend. And, you know, this new pair of glasses was mentioned. And I believe that is the most brilliant set of talks that have had a great impact in my life. And in it, he says, the one problem that includes all problems is conscious separation from this power. And the one solution that includes all solutions is conscious unity with this power. And so I say to myself, I can make this conscious unity happen, right? Now, you know who says that? My ego. That's my ego talking. I can make this happen. I can surrender myself. Now, what I've since learned is I cannot surrender myself. I don't have the power, but God does. And what's necessary for me to do is to commit to wanting that enough to do the work, steps 4 through 12, and then waiting for it to happen. And 4 through 12, as I described, tear off a little piece of that towel, throw it in. And I do that enough, I work those steps enough, and it's happened to me. And the other part of the step 3 is as we understood Him. And I want to talk a little bit about that, because I say, thank God for that phrase. Because I get to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I am not a religious person. I don't follow a religion. I don't believe in a religion. I am not a member of a religion. And if in AA I had to believe a certain way, I could not be here. Especially when I was new. Now, I don't have anything against religion. I love religion. I love religion for the people for whom it works. My wife, devout Catholic. I love the Catholic Church and what it brings to her life. But it's not for me. Now, I have a concept of this power and a belief in this power and a faith in this power, but it's as I understood him. Okay? That means it's a power that works for me. So if you're sitting in this room today and you're thinking, I can't do this thing because the God thing, and it really trips a lot of us up. I want you to hear this. You don't have to believe anything except what works for you. You don't have to believe anything except what works for you. And whatever works for you today is enough. It says that very clearly in our book. It says, this conception, however inadequate, was enough for me to do this work. Okay, so that's enough. And I can tell you that I had a very inadequate conception of God in the beginning. And it's very different today. And the step is kind of a trick in a way, because it says, my own conception of God, which is a conception that comes out of my ego. Isn't that interesting? Because it's my conception, right? But that's enough. And now today, what I think this, as we understood it, means, and this is just for me, is my own experience of this power. So I say, I don't understand this power at all. I can't understand. I believe this power is infinite, and I'm not. But what I can do is experience it, and I experience it. I experience the power. So if you're here and you're having a tough time with that, just keep coming. Believe whatever works for you. And if your experience is anything like mine, it will evolve. And here's what I believe. For me, it better evolve. That means I'm growing. Okay, that means I'm growing. So when I was new, my third step basically looked like this, the first one. I went over to my sponsor's house. We got on our knees. We said the prayer. I didn't have any big thing happened. Like, okay, yeah, whatever. And then I began to do the rest of the steps. But let me tell you how I work it today. I did that this morning. I did this very thing this morning. The book says, on awakening, our thoughts turn to the 24 hours ahead. So what happens is, and I've trained myself to do this over the years, when I wake up, the first thing I do, turn my thoughts to God. I have to do this, because if I waited until I had my coffee and breakfast or whatever, I'd be too late. So I turn my thoughts to God, and I say basically steps 1, 2, and 3. I say this: God, of and by myself, I have no power, not only over alcohol, but pretty much everything else. And of and by myself, my life is unmanageable. But you are the power, and you are the manager. And then I do step 3, which is turn my will and life over to his care. And what that looks like is I say a prayer that I stole from Chuck C. And it basically goes like this. This is my prayer. So if you don't like this, just kick it under your chair. But I'm reporting for duty. This is not my day. This is your day. So I'm going to get up and I'm going to put my one foot in front of the other. I'm going to do the work that I think you would have me do this day. Please let me know what that is. And I'll go wherever you want me to be, to go see whoever you want me to see, say what you want me to say, hear what you want me to hear, and this is not my day, it's yours. And when I do that, I feel connected and as though the power is with me. I feel figuratively, I don't believe my higher power has hands, but if he did, I feel as though I'm held in the hands of my higher power. And I feel peace. My mind is quiet. That feeling behind my chest is calm. And then I make the big mistake of my day is I get up and go mess everything up. But anyway, I have other steps to work for those. We'll hear about those later. And I got about 6 minutes, so I'm going to tell a story. I may go over a little bit, so sorry. I'll try to tell it fast. The story starts about a year ago. A year and a couple weeks ago. First of all, I'm going to tell you, I practice a really healthy lifestyle. I eat well. I exercise daily. I ride my bike an hour a day, almost every single day. I like that lifestyle. I like feeling good. And I started to feel, about a year ago and a bit, kind of lightheaded. And what's the other word I describe it as? Dizzy. Oh, that's lightheaded. Short of breath. So I'm short of breath and I'm lightheaded. And it's kind of happening and I'm like,
what the heck's going on? And I go to Jane and I say, Jane, I just want you to know I'm feeling this every now and then. It doesn't happen often. I feel lightheaded. I feel short of breath. And she said, James, it's stress. You're working too hard. Stop working too hard. And she's right. I'm one of those alcoholics that works harder than my boss expects me to. Anybody else do that? And putting in a lot of hours. And I said, you're right. It's stress. And I'm just going to, so I did, and it, you know, but I still kept experiencing it, and it's slowly getting worse. And again, it happened every now and then, so I just sort of passed it off on this. One day, Sunday before Thanksgiving, that'll be a year ago tomorrow, I'm walking Angus. His ears just popped up right there. I'm walking Angus, we're walking up the hill, and I literally almost passed out. I had to grab the fence. And so I go home and I said, Jane, I got to do something about this. I'm calling the doctor. The next day was Monday before Thanksgiving. I called the doctor. I said, I really need to see him. This is what's going on. They said, we can't see you tomorrow, Tuesday before Thanksgiving, but we can see you Wednesday. So, okay. Made an appointment for 9:30. Now, the day before Thanksgiving is a yearly date for my wife. She gets together with Christy, one of her best friends, and they do like this Thanksgiving thing. They have a meal, they shop, and do all this stuff. And she was going to take the car, and I said, I need the car. I got to go to the doctor. She said, don't worry, I'll have Christy come get me, and I'll go to lunch with Christy. I said, fine. So I go to the doctor, 9:30 in the morning. He hooks me up to an EKG, comes back 5 minutes later, and he said, you need to go to the emergency room right now. I'm like, what? He said, right now. And by the way, go to the emergency room in the satellite emergency room up there because they'll see you right away. Don't go to the main hospital. You'll be waiting in there for hours. I said, okay. And I said, follow directions. So I got on the phone. And I said, Jane, I got to go to the emergency room. Will you drive me? And she said, does that mean I have to cancel my lunch plans? Yes. She goes, of course. So I drive the car home, and then she drives me. Go into the emergency room. They saw me right away, like tons of people. Come over to me, like, oh, it was a Formula 401 race car and all these. And the next thing I know, the doctor on call looks at my heart rate on the monitor, and he said, you are not going home today. You need to go to the main hospital, and you're going to have some surgery. And I'm like, wow, okay. And I thought, Jane will drive me. And I said, okay, Jane, let's go. And he goes, oh, no, those guys over there are going to take you. So over there were the paramedics with their little cart and everything. And they put me on the cart and started wheeling me to the ambulance. And on the way down in the elevator, the driver says to the EMT, you know, he's stable. What, should we do code 1 or code 2? And I said, look, dudes, I've never been in an ambulance. You got to give me code 2. I mean, I want the lights. I want the sirens. Woo! So he said, okay. So down the road we go. Woo, woo, woo. He said, hey, man. I had an IV in my right arm. He said, hey, man, they really like when you have two IVs, so I'm going to give you one. I'm like, dude, we're driving down the road. And he goes, no worries. I know every pothole in the street. So he goes, wait. Okay. So I get there and I'm like, yeah, so then we go into the emergency room. They have a room waiting. They hook me up there. They're on me. In walks the cardiologist on call and said, James, what you have is what's called a cardiac AV block. And it's to the point where you need surgery. You need a pacemaker. And I said, okay. And who are you exactly? You know, you know how we are, right? She said, well, I'm a cardiologist here at the hospital. I've been here for 25 years. And by the way, the surgical unit that we would wheel you into, I started that 25 years ago. I said, oh, okay. And she said, this is what you need. This is what it's going to be like. And oh, by the way, it's the day before Thanksgiving. I want to send my surgical team home. So if you're going to do it, you got to do it right now or wait till Monday. And here's the whole point of this story. I looked at Jane. Jane looked at me, and in that moment, we connected, and we knew in that moment that we were figuratively held in the hand of God. That not only was everything going to be okay, everything was okay. We looked at each other and we said, let's do this. So the next thing you know, they wheel me in to the surgical unit. The guy puts me under. He said, you ready? And I said, let's go. And he starts that drip. And I went, oh, boy. And then I was out. Right? And then next thing I know, I come to. And I'm like, woo, this is great, man. If you're new in AA, that's called a freelapse. I had one. It was great. It's great. Hey, I'm an alcoholic every day. All right? I come out of it. Jane looks at me and says, honey, your color is back. I felt instantly better. It was like that. I was like, oh, my God, I'm back to myself. And it works great. So my pacemaker does this job. It keeps my heart at 60 beats per minute or higher. And it's doing a real good job. And I don't feel lightheaded and I don't feel short of breath. I do everything I ever did. I just do it without feeling like I need to pass out. Now, through this entire experience, I felt as though I was in a state of surrender. I did not put myself there. God did. And the reason God put me, I believe, God put me in that state of surrender because I did the work that allowed that state of surrender to happen. And that work was the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is the power of step 3, I think. And, yeah, I think I'm done. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you so much for asking me to be here. I'm so excited for our next speaker, my beautiful wife, Jane. Let me tell you a little bit about Jane before she starts. That moment in that emergency room is how Jane is. She's what you're going to experience from her talk is who she is. What you see is what you get with her. She's solid. She has a strong faith in God. She works in an amazing program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love you so much, honey. You're just I'm so grateful that you're my partner. And last thing I'll share about this story is that she said, who do you want me to call? And I said, I think you should call my kids, let them know this is happening. And my daughter said to me later, she said, when Jane called, it was kind of scary, but she was just so cool and together in that moment that I felt like everything was going to be okay. And that is your next speaker. And I'm also looking forward to the rest of the speakers. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love all of y'all. Thanks.